Call this meeting to order. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Representative Clark, have you read the minutes thoroughly? Oh, we kind of don't have enough?
Not quite.
Okay, we'll wait on that. We have Minnesota Housing Finance. Welcome to our committee again.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning.
You're getting very good at this, by the way.
Thank you very much. The proof will be in the results, won't it, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
That's right. My name is Tim Marks. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I'm here today to present the Governor's recommendation for a capital bonding proposal for $20 million for supportive housing in support of the plan to end long-term homelessness in Minnesota by 2010. I believe you may have, or when Tanya Orr gets here, she has a one-page summary of our proposal, as well as an article that recently appeared in the Star Tribune. So that will be distributed shortly. Okay. Just a brief background, Mr. Chair and members. In 2003, the legislature adopted legislation that was initiated by the Plenty administration to establish a broadly representative working group of government at all levels, local government, philanthropic organizations, and service providers, and faith-based communities to look at the issue of long-term homelessness in Minnesota and to develop a comprehensive plan to address the issue. That plan was submitted to this legislature last March, and as a part of the bonding proposal the governor submitted last year, he submitted a $20 million proposal for supportive housing. There are approximately 2,800 households, 3,300 Minnesotans who are long-term homeless, and these are people who are on the streets persistently for long periods of time and have significant issues with chemical dependency, mental illness, victims of domestic abuse. Many are veterans with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And we have learned that providing supportive housing, which this proposal does, is that we can reduce their reliance on crisis services, emergency rooms, detox facilities, trouble with law enforcement, get them into housing, provide enough support services so they can be successful in their housing, and their reliance on crisis services reduce. We save those costs, and we have better outcomes for these individuals. The $20 million proposal before you is part of a seven-year plan to end long-term homelessness in Minnesota that, from all costs and all sectors, we estimate will cost about $740 million. The good news, Mr. Chair and members, is that we moved forward with this plan, notwithstanding the lack of a bonding bill last session, because of the ability to mix in other resources. The first goal of our year's goal for our plan was to finance 200 units of supportive housing throughout the state, and I'm pleased to report that we have financed over 270 supportive housing units throughout the state by using other resources. Now, the bonding resources, which the governor proposes, are still very critical to our plan because we need those other resources for operating and rental subsidies and other aspects of the plan. The proposal before you, depending upon how it's leveraged, will create anywhere between 260 and 530 units of supportive housing throughout Minnesota. We estimate 50% in greater Minnesota in the next couple of years. We urge your support for this proposal. It has received wide support on a bipartisan basis from all sectors of the community, from government at all levels. The governor testified before the Interagency Council on Homelessness in Washington last year, which is a cabinet-level group, and we came away with $1.75 million of grants. There was a special appropriation for this effort that Congress passed last year, an earmark that is going to assist in this effort of $250,000. The philanthropic community is coming to support of this. As I mentioned when I was here last week, the McKnight Foundation and St. Paul Travelers has established a special initiative fund to be administered by the Family Housing Fund that will assist in the service side of this initiative. And you will see in the governor's operating budget that will be proposed on January 25th, other proposals that will move this plan forward. The individuals that and families that this initiative will support are among our most vulnerable and represent the most visible manifestation of our affordable housing problem here in Minnesota. So we urge your support, and I'm here to take any questions, as is Ms. Ziller.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I
I'm absolutely no doubt about the extent of the challenge that we have and the need we have. As a matter of fact, we've sponsored through Health and Human Services before some pretty aggressive supportive housing initiatives. But one of the things that some of my friends in the kind of the apartment world tell me is, why are we constructing new when in so many places we have occupancies that are low? There's available places that we wouldn't have to do any brick and mortar if we just applied that money to what's already available in the market.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, our plan is a comprehensive plan that has a mix of new construction, a mix of rehabilitation. The largest share of units of the 4,000 units we plan, 1,600, will be just as you described. We're going to be working with private landlords to provide the tenants sufficient rental assistance and work with the landlords. The tenants have the actual services that are necessary so that they can be successful tenants. So the largest share of this problem and the most cost effective will be the extent to which we can provide rental assistance. Now, it is going to take some new construction, and we estimate about 500 new units over the course of these several years. But for the entire comprehensive plan for the 4,000 units over the 7 years, the largest number of units, 1,600, is for pure rental assistance to be obtained in the private market. And we've already started that process, by the way, Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then just sort of a technical question. On that component, it would be a little unusual to bond for just sort of rental assistance.
Yeah.
Is there some part of this money that is going to be used for rental assistance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, the $20 million before you would be used for capital. But this $20 million is part of a more comprehensive plan that involves appropriations that the governor is going to recommend as a part of the MHFA budget that will be used for rental assistance, as well as other resources that the Housing Finance Agency has devoted to this effort. So the $20 million before you was only for a portion of the capital piece as a part of a comprehensive plan.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one accompanying, at least in the experience that I've had in this field, it's one thing to have a place to be, but the complex situations you're talking about typically call for a lot of pretty complicated services in order for things to really work. And that's other fun. Is there some sort of plan with the kind of the services side of the funding to support those families then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, there is, as a part of our business plan, a comprehensive review of the services that are going to be provided for these individuals, and there's a particular financial estimate for what those services are going to cost. And you will see in the governor's recommendation and operating budget a way to try to address that issue to provide these supportive services, because you're exactly right. To be successful tenants, these individuals do need services over time. And again, the philanthropic community, recognizing that is a key challenge of this plan, which is to provide the necessary services, has capitalized an initiative fund that is going to be dedicated exclusively to the service end of this in partnership with government.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, and you know, I hope all this comes together and works sort of long term, because you're right. This is a very serious beat. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I appreciate your bringing this forth, and I'm just wondering what criteria will determine what Greater Minnesota cities? You said approximately 50% of these 4,000 homes will be in Greater Minnesota. So would they be in regional cities, or how will that be determined?
Commissioner Mark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruth, over the last year there has been a lot of publicity and outreach as a part of this proposal, and we know communities are working on proposals that would be eligible for this bonding money. So we have a pipeline of about 800 units that are in the works for this construction, many of which are in Greater Minnesota. So that's an estimate based upon what we think proposals are going to be in the pipeline that will eventually be able to be mature enough to be financed. And we have a number of partner organizations who are going out throughout the state to try to work with communities to develop proposals to address this issue. So that's an estimate based upon what we see in the pipeline developing from communities.
Any other questions? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, could you kind of give us some insight into what you envision as these nonprofits and their supportive services are? I mean, are they reading classes, or are they how to cut grass, or chemical dependency. Just give us some kind of a view of what you're talking about in terms of supportive services.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, one of the things that we learned throughout this process is that we really have to do two things when we look at services. One, tailor them to the individual and be very careful in making sure that the services actually directly help that individual address challenges that have prevented them from being successfully housed. And so there is a whole number of type of services that our providers are becoming expert about that individuals need. As an example, at the most elemental level, some of the tenants just need somebody at the front desk of the place they live who gets to know that person, watches the traffic coming in and out, asks them, are they on their meds? Do you need a ride to the doctor? If so, we have a faith-based organization that's willing to do that, or we can count your county caseworker. It's pretty service-light. There are other situations, and this is primarily for many of the families, where there does need to be more intensive education services, chemical dependency services, and other things. In fact, one in your district that is run by New Foundations, I believe, is a more intensive service-type facility. What we want to do as a part of this effort is, because services are very costly, is be very strict in scrutinizing the service levels so that we make sure they're tailored to the individual and that they're cost-effective, but that we also, particularly for those intense cases, work with our counties and special service providers like Wilder and Catholic Charities and many others to make sure that people get the services they need. And that's going to be a central challenge of this plan, and we have a lot of learning left to do.
Well, Mr. Mahoney. That brings up an interesting point, and as I'm thinking, listening to your answer, are most of these 4,000-plus units, are you looking at apartments, or are you looking at single-family homes, duplexes, mix of what? And if it's a mix, do you have a ratio that you're trying to aim for?
Mr. Chair, that's Representative Mahoney. As I spoke with Representative Bradley earlier, we have a mix of strategies. We think about 1,600 of these 4,000 units, and this is a plan, we can actually, and there are models of this that exist right now, where the Wilder Foundation, for example, has its RIF program, where they will work with individuals who are homeless, provide them the rental assistance, some of which comes from government, the MHFA, and then work with a landlord to get the landlord to accept these individuals and tenants, and then work with the tenant to make sure the tenant has services so that if there's a problem with the landlord can call Wilder and the RIF project and say, we're having some problems here. Can you help us figure out what's going on? So there are a number of models throughout the state of nonprofit organizations who serve as an intermediary between the landlord and the tenant so that as problems come up, they are addressed quickly before the relationship deteriorates and you have an eviction. A lot of these individuals have led extremely chaotic lives, and being in stable housing, things like, you know, cleaning and maintenance are things they're not familiar with, and they have to be coached on over time. And that's the reason for the service provider.
Representative Mahoney. So you didn't answer part of the question. Do you have that ratio of single-family homes to apartments, or duplexes to multi-unit apartment complexes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, sorry for not being more comprehensive. The plan calls for 500 units of new construction, and that would primarily be smaller multifamily units, I expect, or it may be units that are built in to other developments. For example, at the library that is being financed at University in Dale, that also has 110 units of housing built into it, we're going to have 10 units for supportive housing. So that's going to be part of it. Second, it's going to be acquisition and rehabilitation, existing facilities out there that can be acquired and then rehab for this purpose, and that will be anything from, you know, apartment buildings to perhaps some retrofitted commercial space. It's just we have to kind of work with the market and get the word out there and start generating proposals. And that's going to be 1,500 units, mixed-use units like University in Dale, 400 units, and then rental, pure rental and operating assistance through programs like the Wilder Roof Program, that will be 1,600 units. And these numbers were built or developed as a part of our comprehensive planning process, where we work with developers, we work with local governments to try to get a sense of what was out there. And we'll continually adjust this as we have experience with it.
Thank you. And then one last question.
Representative Mahoney.
Do you think your agency could come up with a number of low-income units, not just yours, but low-income units available? Maybe break it down. You know, I've seen some stuff by county, but break it down even smaller, whether it's Senate districts or legislative districts, because, you know, I seem to think and have the sense, my constituents have the sense that low-income housing gets concentrated in certain areas and other areas gets bypassed. So it'd be nice if there was a way that you could kind of tell us where it is and, you know, where it's not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, there are services that do that, and we'll try to get that information to you. There's an organization called Housing Link that tries to keep track and be an information referral source for much of this. Although, you know, there is some flaw in that record keeping because in many instances, the private market operating on its own does address a lot of our affordable housing needs. But we'll provide you with what information that is available on that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I want to commend you, Commissioner. This is such an important initiative, and it is, as you mentioned earlier, it's always been a bipartisan issue that we've all been able to really work on, and it's great, especially with Representative Bradley sitting here and making some of his comments about working together on the supportive part of the housing as well. I'm really glad we've got this back at the table, and I hope we get it past this time and get the construction going. I have a couple of questions. One of them is, you mentioned you were creative and you're already able to construct 270 units for the existing funds that were taken from some other program. Can you tell me where those dollars came from, and are we backfilling that, or what is the plan there?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the units that we have financed have come partly from the low-income tax credit that the federal government authorizes. We are reserving as a part of this plan 25% of our allocation of low-income tax credits. It's come from the Housing Trust Fund, which this legislature appropriates to us every 2 years. And the third major source is our agency resources. The Housing Finance Agency has devoted from its bond funds $50 million as a part of this plan over the 7 years to address and prioritize toward this need. Finally, Representative Clark, just in response to your comment about this effort, I really do have to commend my colleagues, Commissioners Goodnow and Fabian, and their departments, who worked very hard with us as a part of the team, and we co-chaired this working group to develop this plan. And to be successful, it's going to take a mix of housing and human services and corrections, as well as other resources from the working group that put this together. But this cannot just be a housing issue, and it has not been.
Mr. Chair?
Partly
then what I'm wondering, for example, the money that came from the Housing Trust Fund, I don't know how much that was. I know if that serves some of our neediest people. Is that going to be... in your budget proposal for this year, I guess we don't quite have it yet, but do you anticipate we'll be putting some additional dollars into the Housing Trust Fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I am not at liberty to comment on the governor's budget right now, but I can say that this is the governor's highest housing priority, and we are all committed to implementing this plan.
Okay. I'll wait for that information. One of the things I noted here is the loans are deferred and deemed paid in full after 20 years. Mr. Chairman, 20 years when I first got elected seemed like a long time. Now that I've been here more than 20 years, 20 years doesn't seem like a very long time. And I'm wondering, and then certainly in the world of housing, it's not that long. Has the agency explored, or would you consider exploring, some of the ways that would extend this affordability of this housing beyond the 20 years? For example, the community land trust options, other ways that you could work with cities, provide... I'm just wondering if there's some way to build in, and I know you've got talented people working for you, like Ms. Orr and others, who may have already thought of this, but I'm just wondering, have you thought of ways to extend it beyond 20 years? Because I think of the veterans and the people with mental illness and the people who have some of these serious problems, it's a lifetime worth of their problems, and that cause them to be homeless. So what have you thought about going beyond 20 years in some ways?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, 20 years is generally the useful life of a facility, and that's, if we go any longer than that, one, we don't get people to commit their resources and time and energy to building and owning these units. As we move on, and as this legislature has supported us with a separate program, it's our housing preservation program. And I expect as my successors, as they come before your successors 10, 15, 20 years from now, we'll be talking about the resources that are necessary to preserve these units and their affordability long term. And that is a large part of the mission of this agency that we currently do, is significant efforts on preservation. Resources that this legislature allocates and other resources that we deploy for preservation.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I raised this issue is actually the issue of preservation. I think the agency has found itself caught with some of the Section 8 HUD dollars that were spent years ago by developers who then had like a 20, 25, maybe even 30-year promise to keep that housing affordable. And all of a sudden we're left with all these elderly people and people on low incomes, particularly elderly people, though. Their housing is threatened, and we've had to put a special fund in place in our agency here to help
to preserve
it. And mm-hmm. and I think you were here when we had the whole room filled with elderly people, lots of gray and white heads out there saying, "Please preserve our housing." And I'm thinking, if we can figure out ways to do that with this investment right up front, the more we can do that, I just think better. So
we should make sure it's done.
Because otherwise the market really drives those prices up and that housing becomes unaffordable. And what we've learned, I think, from that is that you can't build it in the future like you can build it for right now. So this investment. Anyway,
one good thing that we're going to look forward to is having a community land trust discussed in this committee that will preserve those things. And since you mentioned age, I'm a little older than you are, but 20 years ago, you realize how old Representative Sirdis was? 10?
I was alive at least.
10? 10, is that about right? 9 or 10?
9.
Yeah. Amazing. But anyway, I appreciate your comments very much. I agree with you.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, can I ask a couple other legislators how old they were at that particular time?
No. Any other
questions?
Representative Westenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner, I'm curious as far as, do you keep any success ratios or statistics on how successful, you've been in the past and, what reasons, maybe give you to believe that this is going to be successful in helping people not be homeless after participating in these programs? I think it's a really good program, and I think it's great that we're working together to get this done, and it certainly is a worthwhile effort, but I just would like to know how successful it really is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westerberg, we know, based upon the evidence that we reviewed as a part of our business planning process, and we'll come and visit with you about and review with you the business plan, where Minnesota has about 2,000 units of existing supportive housing, and we have good evidence that it does do as promised, reduce crisis services and increase outcomes for the individuals involved. So we have enough evidence from what's gone on across the country and here in Minnesota that this is a successful model. Mm-hmm. However, a critical component of our business plan is to do the type of evaluation which you suggest. And so as a condition of getting funding through this initiative, there's going to be various reporting and tracking requirements for the individuals so that we can evaluate and adjust the plan as necessary, adjust the service levels, and as well report to this legislature. And through Representative Bradley's work and Commissioner Goodnow, there's also been the Heart Connection Project, which is a model that this legislature has funded on a pilot basis that we're starting to get results from as well that are positive and that will be reported to this legislature.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, because I think that's really important, the tracking part of it, because obviously I'm sure the need is there, and if the units are full, there's success there. But how are we helping the people? Are they going in and out? Are they still in trouble? That's my concern. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's our concern as well.
Okay. I don't see any other questions with that. Thank you very much for your overview. Oh, excuse me. Representative Sirdis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can see me in my booster seat. Probably wasn't going to
be. Don't give me that stuff.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Commissioner, when I look at supportive housing, I'm very supportive of it, but we talk a lot about the bricks and mortar today, and you touched on briefly in one of your answers, I think, to Representative Mahoney about co-chairing this with Department of Corrections. Department of Human Services. Now with Human Services melded into this committee structure, I'd be interested, and not much for you to comment because this is other agencies, so I don't want you to have to put words in their mouths or represent them, but I'd like to see what they're bringing to the table as far as this goes. Supportive housing only works when you have those services provided. You touched a bit on our public-private partnerships, Wilder Foundation, faith-based initiative. That's good. But in order to finish that safety net, I believe this committee has to see what Human Services and Corrections is bringing to the table as well, or at least Human Services under our purview. So I'm hoping when this discussion happens, when the bills move forward, that Commissioner Goodnow or the experts in his agency can come forward and we can see what the full scope is on what we're dealing with.
Where all the funding comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. We'll make a point of that. Thank you very much. Anybody else has questions? Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Mr. Field. We can't put you aside this time.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, thank you for the invitation to be here today. My name is Gary Fields. I'm with the Blandon Foundation. As many of you know, Blandon Foundation is Minnesota's biggest regional foundation outside the metro area, and it's focused on rural economic vitality. A little over 2 years ago, we started a broadband initiative because we realized that broadband telecommunications and the usage of it and the deployment of it is absolutely critical to rural economic vitality. I'm here today to talk to you a little bit more about that and carry our policy message. I don't have a specific proposal for you, but I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about why this is so critical and I think where you'll get some opportunities in the future to look at this issue. The story I'm about to tell is a recurring theme. As new technologies emerge, some communities, some states, some regions embrace them, others resist them, and I'm really here to talk about how we can really embrace some of these new technologies because really our economic survival depends upon it. Communities need broadband-based technologies if they're going to survive. In our global economy, we're competing every day with every country, businesses all over the world. We're not just competing with our neighbors. The trade barriers are dropping down. It means you have to be faster, more productive, more efficient, more if you're going to be able to compete. The U.S. generally has higher labor costs, higher costs, governmental costs, higher resource costs. So we need every advantage that we can find if we're going to compete effectively in the global economy. Rural communities have some additional disadvantages. They generally have higher transportation costs. They don't always have access to all of the business services. But rural communities can ship data, they can ship information as efficiently as anybody. So this is really a great opportunity for rural communities. You know, 5 or 10 years ago, we were concerned about the outsourcing of some of the jobs that were going to different parts of the world, and they were generally low-wage jobs. Today, what we're outsourcing are high-wage jobs, and it's happening because telecommunications is making that possible. SciMed moved their medical manufacturing to Ireland. There are, if any of you talked to a computer helpline recently, you probably talked to somebody in India. These high-tech jobs are being outsourced around the world, and if we don't compete better, we're going to obviously lose a tremendous opportunity that is available to us. In today's global economy, we're not competing with South Dakota and Iowa and Wisconsin anymore. In today's economy, we're competing with the rest of the world. If you look at where broadband technologies, where the penetration rates are the greatest, this chart is pretty much impossible for you to read, but this, if you look at the top of this chart, there's all Pacific Rim countries. The penetration rates for broadband technology are way ahead of the United States. The United States in this chart is down around 10. So we are nowhere near the lead in broadband-based technology or the usage of it and the application of all these services and applications. The lead with Korea, Hong Kong, Canada. Canada is number third, incidentally. China, Denmark, Belgium, Ireland. The Pacific Rim is by far ahead of us. Europe is ahead of us, particularly Northern Europe. We are losing this battle. So these are the broadband penetration rates around the world, and we're not doing very well. on this, and I want to talk a little bit more about how we can improve this and
Mr.
what it really
Fields,
means
what is
for
the penetration
our
rate in Minnesota?
Right now, in if you look state in outside the metro area, we're looking at around in the 15 to 20% range. And if you look at all of Minnesota, including the metro area, we're just a little bit higher of the population that actually subscribes to broadband, some type of broadband service, including businesses, institutions, governments, everybody.
What was it 7 years ago?
7 years ago, well, there really wasn't much broadband. It was in the single digits. I mean, we have made progress.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest challenge, and I'll come back to this message a couple of times. Our biggest challenge is not infrastructure. We actually have service that's available to most of Minnesota. 85%, at least 85% of Minnesota has access to some type of broadband service. May not be as cheap as people want, or it may not have the speed, or what, but they have access to it. The biggest problem is people don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to utilize it, how to make themselves more productive or efficient with it. So that's really our biggest challenge. As we get people using it more, then we will face an infrastructure challenge. And I'll say another few words about that as well.
Representative Bravo has got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You brought up the idea of getting people to understand the service and how it can be utilized in their situation. Like, for example, I'm a network engineer, so I'm really interested in this stuff. I talked to my parents about getting broadband, and I got them a cable modem, and so these are all the great things you can do with it. And now my dad says, oh, great, I can check my NASCAR Fantasy League and check my stats, or my mom sends me 30 pictures instead of 10 pictures of, you know, us when we were kids. How, from a strategic perspective, how can we really get people to use broadband and to use the Internet the way we want them to, as opposed to the more commercial interests that are pushed?
Mr. Fields.
Chairman, Representative Baracko, great question. Actually, the foundation created a program called Get Broadband that we've rolled out now across the state. We just had our first round of funding this fall, where we have program and a grant and grants where we get out and demonstrate to residents, businesses, schools, medical facilities, governments, all of the different applications and services that are available via broadband. On the residential side, we find that there's a huge range of things. It's very personal. What actually appeals to you individually, and for the businesses and healthcare institutions and schools, it's a little more confined to where we show them some of the productivity tools that are available and actually get out and demonstrate to them what's available. So it's really an educational mission. We started on it this fall. The foundation committed about $250,000 to these Get Broadband grants, and like I say, we're doing our first seven now. And actually, I encourage you to have your communities look at this. We have another round of funding coming up at the end of February. If you look at the foundation's website, there's information about Get Broadband.
One more. Just to make sure I understand, I was reading this and it says that Minnesota's ranked 19th in broadband utilization, but 9th in all types of home internet service. When we're making the categorization for broadband, we're assuming it's like basically all home internet service. That's going to include just analog lines, wireless, ESL, cable. All that's going to be categorized as broadband, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garoppolo, the definition of broadband, next slide, is today, and actually it's really yesterday's definition, is something that's always on and it's 256 kilobits per second or above. When we talk about all internet access, we include dial-up. When we talk about broadband, we actually are talking about anything that's always on, so that could be wireless, it could be cable, it could be DSL, any service that's always on that's at least 256K. What we're finding now is that 256 really isn't broadband anymore. You know, yesterday's definition was 256K because it delivered a lot faster than dial-up service, and what we're finding now is the applications that are available over broadband really require much more than 256K. So by the end of this year, if you have less than one megabit service, people won't consider it broadband. But when we talk about the future, and the future, I'm really only talking about next year, we're talking about something that's much higher, 100 megabit service to the home, or 1 gigabit service. In the Pacific Rim, they have 1 gigabit service, which is over 1,000 times greater than what most people have in Minnesota right now. And they're rolling this out in Japan, in Korea, In Utah right now, they just deployed a program for going to 15 communities where every home will get 100 megabit service and every business will have 1 gigabit service. So the definition keeps changing because the applications that come over broadband, the things that make us more productive and efficient, require greater bandwidth. So today we have 85% of the state served with some type of broadband, but as that definition climbs, that number is going to drop, and that's where we need to be thinking ahead and seeing what can we do to work with the private sector to make this possible. I should also mention that our effort is guided by a strategy board made up of 15 people. We have the CEOs of 6 different broadband service providers that represent all the technologies, all the delivery mechanisms, as well as we have legislative and administrative officials. Representative Gunther is on our strategy board. We have Commissioner Kramer, some public officials, public leaders, and some local business owners. So we have a very good broad cross-section of people that are advising us and trying to help guide our efforts on this issue as we move forward. And it's been a very dynamic group. It's the most bipartisan cross-section of public and private people and leaders I've ever worked with, and it's been really exciting to get that consensus developed. So today, again, the definition keeps changing, and we really need to be prepared to increase our capacity if we're going to compete with the rest of the world. Businesses absolutely have to have broadband access to compete in the global marketplace. I can talk forever about it, giving you examples of businesses that had to have it and why it was part of their decision to locate. Total Card expanded in Laverne. This is also a Job Z project, so it wasn't. They didn't move to Laverne just because of broadband, but they absolutely had to have it because it was a service-intensive company, and if they didn't have broadband telecommunications, it wasn't going to work. And Laverne has five broadband service providers. It's one of the best-served communities in the state. But broadband service, high-speed service, is now an essential part of our infrastructure, just like water and sewer lines, or, you know, 100 years ago it was railroads, or 50 years ago it was highways. Now it's broadband telecommunications, and if you don't have it, you're going to lose. If you have it, you're going to be able to compete effectively. But businesses have to have it. They order their raw materials. They have access to their parts. They have access to their customers. They can find things cheaper and quicker. Many suppliers require the customers to be online to do purchasing. Service companies or the service departments have their information on the web, and manufacturing operations monitor a lot of their activities over the internet. In Grand Rapids, the foundation's hometown, we just had a small company named WinLogix use broadband telecommunications to analyze wind speeds around the world. They moved to Grand Rapids because that's where they wanted to live. Broadband telecommunications made it possible. Another example is Birch Travel. They're a travel agency. They have about 8 locations around the state. They have employee turnover. It's very costly for them to train their employees. But with broadband telecommunications, it allows their workers to telecommute. The workers can live anywhere, so they stay. They reduce their turnover costs. They have jobs that are accessible all over Minnesota that are well-paying jobs. And it's not just the big businesses that need it. Small businesses need broadband too. Small business people wear many hats, and this helps them manage their finances, sending large files, work with their customers, tax filings. There's a million things that they can do to be more effective, and broadband telecommunications make this possible. Even tourist facilities, which most of our tourist facilities are small, but they're all getting on broadband now, but they have to have it to be able to compete effectively and find their customers. Powerain Systems is a company that's up in Tower, Minnesota. They used to send engineering plans back and forth to their customers in a process that used to take weeks. Now they do it in 30 minutes. They have lost opportunities before they had broadband telecommunications service. They have it now, and they're able to compete more effectively. Broadband's not just for the high-tech businesses, but it also serves our traditional businesses like tourism, mining, farming. These are all services that can be, or all businesses that can be more effective with broadband telecommunications. It's not just for the high-tech businesses, but our farmers are competing globally. Our mining industries are competing globally, and they need broadband to reduce their costs, be more productive and efficient, if they're going to be able to do that. we get outside the business community, and there's other kinds of ways that broadband helps help us be more efficient and more productive, increase our quality of life, lower our costs. Healthcare is just booming, and when you look at the services and the methods that are available over broadband-based technologies. With a lot of rural clinics that used to have to send their patients to to the metro area to be served, now a lot of those services can be done locally with the data shipped to anywhere else where there are physicians that can interpret the results. So it's much more efficient to deliver medical services without having, you know, the patient have to travel hundreds of miles for some tests and services. The data can be put in locally, whether it's an image or some type of medical test. That can be done locally with the interpretation and the analysis done elsewhere. So telemedicine is a huge thing. Also, there are systems now that integrate both the service providers, the hospitals, the clinics, and the physicians and the residents. In Winona, Minnesota, right now, they have a system called Winona Healthcare Online, where every patient, every person in the city can go online, they can make their appointments with their physicians online, they can get test results delivered online, the physicians and hospitals communicate online, and one of the most innovative things is you can establish your own personal healthcare history, so when you travel and you need medical assistance, you can give a physician a secure password and they can get access to your medical history. This is all possible because most of the people in Winona are online. The penetration rate in Winona may be the highest in the state. They are up around 70% because they actually did a program like what became Get Broadband that we sponsored. They did it 10 years ago, and they got everybody excited and informed about what you can do. And so they actually have probably the highest penetration rate in the state, and that's why they actually developed this Winona Healthcare Online program there, and it's been very successful, and we're trying to replicate that around the state.
Mr. Fields, what your effort going to do this year for this committee, and we're going to require a bonding proposal again this year?
Mr. Chairman, we're going to recommend assistance. Probably won't be bonding assistance. Probably general fund assistance to help help show people what to do. As I said, the biggest challenge is really showing people what we can do with our existing infrastructure.
So you're going to market broadband throughout the state with the money that you get from the general fund. How much money are you asking for?
Our recommendation, Mr. Chairman, will probably be to match what Blandon Foundation has put in, which is $250,000.
$250,000? We'll look forward to seeing that bill.
Okay.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Field, you contend that business doesn't know how or why to use broadband, and that's a major factor in only 15% of the 80% of the state using it. Can you also quantify which businesses, schools, families are priced out of using broadband, and price is the factor that's not making them utilize broadband?
Mr. Fields.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sertich, you've raised a very good question, because there's a price point by which businesses or schools or any user, you know, won't go above. And, you know, it varies. There are two sides of that equation. There's a value side and there's a cost side. As you see more things that you can do, and greater value, you're willing to pay more. On the other hand, as more people use it, and the cost, you know, of investing in infrastructure and providing service comes down, the price drops. So we're working on both ends of that equation. We don't have real good data on what the price point is for businesses, because the services and the utilization is all over the map. For the residential population, the price point for quite a while was around $40 a month, and what we've just seen over the last year is some of the broadband providers have their introductory rates at below that, down to $30 a month. Unfortunately, that's the introductory rate, and that gets people exposed to it. That's $256,000, but as I said earlier, that's not going to be broadband for very long. I mean, the things that we do require greater speed than that. So it's a moving target. What we just know, you know, from general business principles, that if we get more people familiar with what's available, they'll use it more because they'll see value in it, and the more people that use it, the more the price will drop, and the easier it will be for the service providers to invest more in infrastructure if they see the take rates go up to 50% statewide. Our goal is to get 50% of the state using broadband based technologies within a year. That's our goal. It's an ambitious goal, but that's our goal. And then we will be more competitive because people will be more productive and efficient, and it'll be easier to invest to get the 1 gigabit type of service in Minnesota if more people are using it. A service provider would be making a pretty poor business decision to invest in that kind of infrastructure when our take rate is this low. But when we get it up there, we can do more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd be interested when the bill comes forward. I don't want to monopolize a lot of time here because I know you got an ambitious agenda today to get through. But I'd like to know the more strategies on how that's going to get done and how the grant process is going to work. It's much easier, in my opinion, if we're going to get to that goal, is to really focus on our colleges and our schools. Those are the learners that are going to be utilizing this technology more. I'm sure President Garofalo probably had a more difficult time getting his parents on board on this. They're not going to be the high-end users that our emerging business leaders who are coming out of our universities and our schools are going to use. So I'm hoping that we're focusing on that side or looking at that.
Pretty difficult to download a book report over a school system.
Yes, I wouldn't know that.
Is that because you've never had a book report or because you've never had a slow system?
Mr. Chair has a theater major, so we just did things, you know, up in the air. My other issue, though, is that we still have to tackle, and it's not as much in here is I view this as a transportation issue and an infrastructure issue. We focus a lot, at least the legislature, governor not so much in his speech, on transportation, in getting goods and services moved, and especially in rural Minnesota, roads, rail, those issues are huge. I'm still looking at not dismissing the 15 to 20% of the state that is not hooked up to broadband. I don't know where it is on a map, so I don't know which area it's in, but I think we have a responsibility to make sure that they have that infrastructure, and I don't know where that falls under, what category of or what agency. The other issue to that, though, is I think we're slipping. If we still have 20% of the state that's not hooked up, we're slipping behind the curve and we're not being bold enough. There are communities like Philadelphia that's going wireless. Our community is going wireless, which is a great step. I'd like to see us also move to our next initiative where we're getting our major communities, our regional centers, just going wireless. That's the cutting edge. That's what keeps us in the forefront as Minnesota and not just trying to keep up with the Pennsylvanias of the world.
Well, Connect Minnesota tried to do that for colleges and schools, and they did have a fairly good attempt at one time. Representative Gravel.
Yeah, I apologize I'm getting into the micro level here, but again, it's what I do. So I see the statistic here that said that there's a certain percentage of Minnesota that doesn't have access to broadband, but my understanding is that with satellite technology, pretty much unless you're in a cave, I mean, everyone has access to it, don't they?
Mr. Fields.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruffle, you're correct in that in the last year there has been deployment of some satellite technologies that are bringing down the cost a little bit. It's still, the satellite-based services are still slower. The upload speeds are poor. The latency, which is the lag time, if you can imagine what it's like sometimes talking overseas on the telephone, the lag, well, when you're sending a signal up to a satellite, that's quite a bit further. And so they don't work that well. They're the best service that's available in some areas because they're the only service. But the speeds are slower, there's latency, and the costs are almost double what would be a comparable speed. So those are being rolled out, and we're happy to see it because in some areas it's the only way to reach some areas, but it's not the best solution.
So final question, then we can let the testifier escape my questioning. So for purposes of these numbers, then satellite is not included as a broadband. But, okay, thank you.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I just want to emphasize a question I think that Representative Sturgis was raising, maybe a little bit more broader, which is I'm really interested in how nonprofit organizations might may or may not have access to this, and the cost factor is certainly a big issue. So we don't have to go into that right now, but, you know, this seems very business, for-profit business oriented, and I'm interested in what kind of initiative for non-profit businesses might also be part of this. Maybe it's there and maybe not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, actually the applications that we introduced to people to get broadband, we're working with schools and hospitals and businesses and residences, and it includes nonprofit institutions as well. Many of the services that they would use would be similar to a business in terms of some of the efficiency opportunities, so we are trying to reach them. I'll continue with just talking a little bit more about the schools. There are some great applications now that are available for schools that integrate the parents and the kids and the teachers. I can go online in St. Paul now, and I can see every assignment that my kids have. I can see the grade. I can tell when it's been assigned. And I don't know how many of you have children or how many of you ever been told, I don't have any homework tonight. But this is an interesting counterpunch to that situation, and I'm surprised some students haven't hacked the system yet, because it's certainly a target out there. But it's a great way to integrate, again, parents and students and teachers. Parental involvement is the number one indicator for student success, and this is a way to increase and improve on parental involvement.
I'm glad they didn't have that when I was in school.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure you did all your homework and all your assignments and never lied to your parents.
Only after my mother became president of the Central School PTA did I do that. we got a pretty full agenda. Can you wrap it up, please?
There are a number of educational opportunities available over broadband from NIMSCU and other providers, that you can get over 800 different degrees over the Internet. Governmental services now have a number of applications that are available that help reduce transaction costs, help provide get information out there that's better. They help the governmental agencies be more efficient. From a residential perspective, there's a tremendous amount that's available, whether it's job searches, telecommuting, whether electronic banking. There's just a tremendous amount that you can do. What we have found in the communities that have been successful in getting broadband out to their community, we get the local leadership engaged with every Get Broadband grant. We have a local steering committee of the community leaders that represent all the different sectors. Vision of where they want to be and how they want to get it is more important, quite frankly, than money. The efforts that have been successful are ones that cross all the sectors. Again, the healthcare, education, business, governmental, and the residential population. That's what we've monitored, and it's been successful. As I said a few minutes ago, we rolled out this grant program this fall. We provided financial assistance. We provide some technical assistance in a program toolkit that includes a lot of the demonstration materials. I think with your permission, I'd like to come back when there's a more formal recommendation from us on Get Broadband and talk to you a little bit more about the program. But in conclusion, I just want to make a couple of points and then I'm done. Broadband telecommunications are an essential part of the community infrastructure. It's essential as anything else that we have now, roads, sewers, power. If you don't have it, your community won't survive. If you've got it and you know how to use it, you'll be able to compete effectively. It's that simple. Second point, we underutilize our existing infrastructure. You know, people, there are plenty of us out there would love to have gigabit service. There's no reason why a service provider would provide fiber to my home when there's only 15% of the people out there using it. So we've got to get people using what's there if we're going to be able to increase our capacity to compete in the world. And with my final comment is that our infrastructure is not as well developed as our global competitors. We really have to start thinking and talking about this now. How are we going to compete with the Pacific Rim and Northern Europe if we're going to be able to compete effectively? That concludes my presentation. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you have.
We'll look forward to seeing your bill. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for not being here, but if you've covered this, you stimulated my interest by saying fiber. But one of the things as a technologist we've got to be a little bit careful about is not assuming whatever the high-rate broadband backbone, those kinds of things, technology is. because today it's cable, tomorrow it's a power line. There are all kinds of technologies, and sometimes I worry that when government tries to get in to be the enabler, we're not fast enough in a really fast evolving technology world. So when you talk about this access, are we sensitive to the rapidly evolving technologies?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, I'm more sensitive than anybody because I have the CEOs of six different broadband service providers that represent all of the different platforms on our steering committee, and they sensitize me to that issue every day. We shouldn't be picking the technology. We should be working with them to figure out how do we, you know, get this to work, and the first thing we can do is the simple and actually the cheapest thing is just show people what they can do with it. And then, you know, as take rates go up, a lot more solutions become available to us.
I know their effort has changed from that of looking for areas that don't have broadband to promoting broadband in all areas, and I think they took a very good turn by trying to inform people of the importance of broadband to them. And I think it's doing a very good job, and I'm glad I'm part of it. So with that, any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your good presentation. And we have an extra presentation coming from Bioscience Building from there. And before we get to them, we got to get the Historical Society next. So we have to make the move a little quicker, I think, so we can get everybody in. So while they're coming down here, Representative Clark, I'm sure you read the minutes very carefully.
And, they were great.
I wondered if you would move the minutes of January 19th.
So moved.
Okay, all in favor of...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question. On the minutes, Representative Mahoney had a presentation of an XXXX file, right? Was that for this meeting? Is that on there? I just didn't see that.
No, it's not on there. Very good point. We got to make sure we get his presentation. We will duly note that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we will correct the minutes. With that correction that we're going to put in there, will everybody please make a motion to approve the minutes as corrected? Okay, all in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We passed the minutes as corrected. Thank you very much. Got to include XXX. You know, in some places, XXX is not a good thing.
Yeah. Like on the internet? Process.
Welcome to the committee. Yeah, maybe.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Patrick McCormick. I'm Deputy Director of the Minnesota Historical Society. And we're here today to talk about our capital budget initiatives. The Historical Society was created in 1849, 9 years before the state of Minnesota was created, and in the ensuing years has been responsible for not only collecting and preserving Minnesota history, but also interpreting Minnesota history. And over the years, that has led to the creation of a historic sites network, which is in over 30 communities in the state of Minnesota. It has led to the creation of a Central State History Museum, an archive for collections in St. Paul, and has led to the creation of a lot of programs, including educational programs, which get us into schools all over the state of Minnesota. As a side impact of our existence, I guess, is the fact that we have over 100 buildings in the state of Minnesota, which we maintain, many of which are historic structures. And from year to year, we have a capital budget bill which addresses needs of those buildings and those historic structures. We also operate a grants program which allows communities, counties, cities to come and partner with the state through a grants program to preserve historic structures in communities in every corner of the state of Minnesota. In recent years, our capital budget bill has focused on a number of projects which we've been very proud of, including the completion of Mill City Museum in Minneapolis, which utilized a broad base of funding, including $7 million in state of Minnesota bonds, money from the federal government, the city of Minneapolis, had a major private fundraising effort. We've completed a new visitor center and exhibit at the Northwest Company Fur Post, which is in Pine City. We've added actually a new visitor center at Split Rock Lighthouse. We have a new completed visitor center and exhibit at the Charles Lindbergh Historic Site. Since we came here to the Capitol last year with our bill, we have also completed a Forest History Interpretive Center in Grand Rapids and have been working on restoring the LaDuke House in Hastings. And the Ramsey House, which is here in St. Paul, we have underway right now exterior work. And finally, we've been restoring the Megan House in historic Forestville. Our capital budget request, which was submitted last year, was for $16,126,000 in capital bonding. The governor recommended, and this is on page 2, by the way, of the booklet, which is being passed out right now, in order to allow you to track. The governor recommended $9,146,000. I'm going to run briefly through the capital request of the Historical Society, and then Bill Keyes, who's the Director of Museums and Historic Sites at the Historic Society, will run through the asset preservation aspects. Our first request was for $7,167,000 in Historic Sites asset preservation. As I noted, Bill Keyes is going to take you through the specific details in a minute of what we're asking for. As an aside, I'll note that historic preservation and asset preservation is always the number one request of the Historic Society. We run historic buildings. We need to preserve those. The second request was for $4.754 million for revitalization and planning for the restoration of historic Fort Snelling. I want to note that this request was cast in terms of Phase 1 and Phase 2, and this represents the Phase 1 restoration of historic structures and planning and design for a new visitor center, which would appear in the 2006 bonding request of the Historic Society as a Phase 2. The third aspect of our request are the county and local historic preservation grants. We give these grants out in a competitive process. They have gone to communities in every corner of the state of Minnesota. I know we're pressed for time, but if you look to page 14 and 15, you'll see some other grants outlined. These grants include the Universal Laboratories building full restoration in the city of Dassel, the Kasson Water Tower in Kasson, Kuching County Courthouse, North Van City Hall. These are projects which we partner with local entities and local efforts to create a joint preservation project. In some cases, cities and counties come year after year to us. We partner over many years. We have a board which reviews the grants from year to year and selects the projects which are ready to go. And we would like $2 million for the county and local bonding agency.
Representative Mooney. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of in the same vein that you're going in, I've been getting a substantial number of emails lately, and I can't imagine that the other members of the committee have not. And one of their main complaints or beratements of you is the spending of money on urban versus rural, which I don't think anyone on the committee, I don't buy into it either. But so that when we try to answer these emails with some facts, could you give us two sets of figures, your spending ratio, or however you want to put it, on urban versus the urban sites that you're working with versus the rural sites, such as the county and local historical preservation grants and the Heritage Trail and some of those things, as your total budget is laid out, and then take out your main museum across the street here so that we kind of have a apples-to-apples comparison so that when we are answering these emails, we have some bets. And I don't really need an answer, just if you could get that number to the from the committee, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we will get those numbers to you. At one point, I took a look at the total bonding and capital budget request of the Historic Society over the last 20 years. And if you look at our historic site network, and if you look at the grants, which are mostly outstate, we have put in, we being the state of Minnesota, this committee, other Senate committees, have put in tens of millions of dollars in outstate construction projects. And I don't want to state a number until I get you the exact figure, but that will be forthcoming to the committee. We do support and want to extend our mission to every corner of the state. Your last presenter talked about broadband access in every corner of the state. We're struggling to build a website that gets us into every corner of the state so that it's not just buildings and capital that we're talking about, but it's also the stories of the people of the state of Minnesota. And we had 3 million visitors to our website last year from every corner of the state of Minnesota. So we are a statewide organization and are really very much committed to that. And this grant project is one of the cornerstones of the ways in which we bring preservation and care for history in every corner of the state. And so it is one of our priorities every year. We also requested $700,000 for acquisition of land near Kelly Farm. And if you've ever been by Kelly Farm, which is up along Highway 10 just north of the Twin Cities, you'll note that every year you'll see a new business, a RV sale dealership, a McDonald's, and we are proposing $700,000 to purchase land adjacent to Kelly Farm to lock in the farming nature of that site so that for future generations there is a feel that this historic farm is actually in farmland. The Friends of the Kelly Farm, which is a group of folks from that area, are here today in the audience, and I know they support this initiative.
Representative Hackbarth mentions that to me often.
The last two pieces of our request were for heritage trails, and these trails were for two specific trail sites. One is connected to Fort Ridgely, and the other is connected to the Forest History Center. And finally, for many years, we've had an operating budget request for a Historic Sites Network Master Plan, and this would be a plan to try to set the future of our Historic Sites Network and to do the sort of planning and background thinking that is necessary to take this Historic Sites Network to the next level. The governor has funded, out of the $16 million request, $9 million $146,000. And this is a very good and reasonable request from the governor. It's something we're pleased with. I promised that we would try to be short because I know you have a quick agenda here, but I think it's important for us to take a second and talk about the asset preservation piece of our plan. And the governor recommended the entire asset preservation recommendation be funded. Bill Keyes, who is the Director of Museums and Historic Sites at the Historical Society, is going to take you through that, which is found, I believe, on page 7 of the handout.
Give your name for the record, please.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Keyes. I'm the Head of Historic Sites and Museums for the Minnesota Historical Society, and I'm going to be talking about the asset preservation needs. If you turn, as Patrick McCormick said, to page 7, you will see a list. This is the same list that was put before you for 04. You can see at the top of the page. And I will point out a couple minor things that are slightly different than when this was initially put together. The first item you see on the list is the Hill House roof. Those of you who know St. Paul know that the Hill House is across the street from the cathedral, and actually it's pretty much a contemporary of the cathedral. Last year, 2 years ago now, you saw them replace the copper roof on the dome of the cathedral. The roof on the Hill House isn't quite that ambitious, but it does involve a lot of the same kind of work we brought today, and you can see on the table over here one of the brackets. That's an eave bracket that would sit underneath the soffit on the house. I think that there's over 100 of those, and as you can imagine, you can't go to Home Depot and buy one of those. You have to, all of this is custom copper work, and just as the roof on the cathedral was all custom copper work, so all the underwork of the eaves on the Hill House and the replacement of all the slate on the Hill House. That slate is slightly more than 100 years old, and that's pretty much the lifetime of slate. I think we got good use out of it, and now we have to get ready for the next 100 years. We're having some pretty significant leak problems there. This item has been on the list for a while, and we really need to get to it this year. And you can see that it's a pretty substantial amount of money to deal with that, but this is a unique piece of Minnesota history. Fort Snelling, you've heard mentioned, and I know that many of you went to Fort Snelling when we did a walkthrough on this request last year. Since then, a couple of things have transpired. The Half Moon Battery, which is the one right behind the Commandant's house, when you looked at it a year ago, was in pretty poor shape. Well, since then, the upper deck on it, the timber frame deck, has collapsed, and it's now got temporary shoring in it. The public is unable to go into that space. Also, the Round Battery, which is the one that you see is typically as almost the logo for Fort Snelling that has the flagpole on it, we are not allowing the public onto the upper deck of that either because of the rotting timbers up there. It's gotten a pretty rapid decline. Much of the timber that's there is 30 years old and obviously is in need of some significant help. This funding here in the asset preservation is focused on work within the walls of the historic fort. There's also a portion of it that of this request that we want to focus on planning for the future. Patrick mentioned that this is part of a phase one in conjunction with the other part in the this budget request. And so we're looking at planning for the future and making sure that when we come back for the 06 request that we've got our ducks in a row and we know what we're trying to do there. The next item here is the Comstock House, which is up in Moorhead. If you turn to the next page, pages 8 and 9, you can see some photographs of some of the items that I'm describing here. On page 9, you can see the Hill House, and there is a photograph there, actually, the middle one, showing how that soffit has completely decayed and parts of it have fallen off. And then for the Comstock House, what we're looking at there, the item is really focused on an ice house, which is, you tend to think of an ice house as something being relatively small, but at the Comstock, it is a sizable building about the size almost of a triple garage. And the foundation has really given way there, and the building is very badly racked and needs to be all the siding stripped off of it and cranked back into a vertical position, and then a lot of repair work done to it. And there are, in addition to that, items at Split Rock Lighthouse where there is some significant work that has to be done with the lighthouse itself. The windows are leaking, water is getting inside the building. Also with the fog signal building, the barns and the dwellings, this is work that over the years, you know, you can imagine with the weather you face on the North Shore up on that rocky promontory, that the weather is not kind, to those buildings. They require some pretty significant work. There's also a number of other ones here with the Harkinstor, Folsom, Ramsey House. And statewide roof replacement, Patrick mentioned that we are responsible for over 100 buildings, and most of those, all but probably a half or a dozen or so of those, are historic buildings. And we have to go through, when you have 100 buildings, we're constantly dealing with roofs. And every year that we do a request here, roofs, approximately this dollar amount you'll see on there, just because there is a you're cycling through with trying to keep up with the age and deterioration of these structures. The last one has to do with monuments and markers that you see along the highway. Those need pretty much a constant stream of repair and upkeep on those. You'll note also at the bottom of page 7 that the governor's recommendation was for the full amount of asset preservation, and we think that that has been pretty much the governor's approach to these kinds of things, and we applaud that. That repairing and taking care of what we have is one of the most important things that we need to do. Unless we plan on not having these buildings, we have to take care of them, otherwise the cost only increases. In my opinion, the work on the Hill House, if we had done it 3-4 years ago, probably wouldn't be as significant as now. Each year that more rain gets in, more snow gets in, more ice gets in, the damage only increases.
I'd like to tell the committee right now that under a normal year, without having to do bonding and budgeting both, we would probably be on a tour.
Yeah.
And it's a tour that I've always looked forward to, and certainly the governor recognizes the thing that the cost that will nothing do nothing but grow if we don't address it, and I appreciate that. Any questions from the members? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate your presentation. This is the first one I saw on money. Thank you. And with that, I think we're going to have the University of Minnesota and Bioscience folks come down and describe their now $24 million bioscience building in Rochester. Yeah, it grew a little bit. And the reasons why is increased concrete costs and materials costs of not addressing it last year. So we'll be anxious to hear how that cost escalated so much.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark?
I hope we can look at those kinds of escalations for all of the software costs that come before this committee.
I think it's a very worthwhile thing to note. And I'm not casting blame anywhere. Welcome to the committee. Will you please give your name for the record?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Power. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center. And my colleague on my left is Dr. Eric Rubin, who is the head of the genomics program at Mayo Clinic. And the two of us are the leaders of the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. We want to tell you about our bonding request, and in order to do that, we want to very briefly tell you about the partnership, because the partnership activities will take place in the building that we're addressing this morning. So first I'd like to just review what we had promised to do several years ago when the state allocated $2 million and each of our institutions allocated an additional $1 million each. So we had a pool of $4 million to fund some very innovative research which took advantage of the two institutions' abilities to work together. We funded four projects, one in obesity, one in Alzheimer's disease, one in heart disease, and one in prostate cancer. And these were selected from amongst 34 applications that involved 250 different investigators. So the well is deep, and there are a lot of very outstanding projects that we just weren't able to fund with the initial funding. We actually didn't get access to the money until about 9 months ago. In that time, we've had amazing success already. And just to let you know, we've had five publications in peer-reviewed journals in obesity and Alzheimer's. We've submitted two grants to the National Institutes of Health, again, one in Alzheimer's and one in prostate disease. We've already filed a patent jointly in Alzheimer's disease. The Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota have opened in the same suite in Minneapolis a Office of Business Development, or two Office of Business Development in the same suite to be able to work with local companies to commercialize our inventions. And clearly all of this has leveraged that initial funding.
So
also, as Dr. Peller was saying,
can you give you a name for the record? So 100 years from now, we can go to the Historical Society and see you talk here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Eric Lieben. I'm the director of the Mayo Genomics Research Center and the Mayo Project Manager for the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. As we presented this project to this committee last year, where the bill was carried by Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, and Representative Mahoney, and supported by a large number of people, and we appreciate that, including Representative Bradley. This was a smaller project. Over the last year, as we've gone from the pre-design phase to the design phase in anticipation of having the funding approved last year, we went further into the design phase. And the updated cost for this building is now estimated as $24.3 million. And the goal here is to provide additional space for partnership activities on the Mayo campus. And this would be structured as a condominium unit that would be owned by the University of Minnesota and then leased back to Mayo for further growth and development of our partnership activities.
I'd like to add one thing. If we wouldn't be adding on to this building, the cost would be substantially more to build a new freestanding building. So it's a positive thing that we have this building to add on to.
Yes,
as the author, I thought I'd throw that in there.
Oh, yes, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly true. When this request for space first came forward, when what was approved for pre-design was a $40 million freestanding structure, and it was only after we got into looking at the options for where would that freestanding structure be and what would the real cost be that we realized that we could achieve significant cost savings by adding on to the existing structures, the Stabile building, and get the same amount of space and functionality out of this at considerably reduced cost.
Representative Mahoney, you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and you may not be the person to answer it, but it's something for we as the committee to kind of consider in the future, if not right now. Is there going to be similar space for partnership use at the on the U of M campus?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, several years ago, the legislature provided funding for our translational research facility, which is on schedule and will be opening this fall, and that will provide some of the new space that we need for these additional activities. So this is the matching facility on the Rochester campus. Just to finish our brief presentation, the activities that will take place on both campuses will require additional funding over the next 5 years, and we're sticking to our original plan, which was estimated of at least $70 million. As you all know, competition in other states makes this an urgency. We have already invested programmatically both at the university and Mayo, and we're still competitive, but we certainly need to take advantage of that. And the benefits for Minnesotans are substantial. Just to remind you, and I won't go into detail on this, we did hire an outside healthcare consultant firm, Tripp Umbach, to look at the economic benefits of the partnership. And if you just focus on the left-hand columns, in 5 years, this initial investment is predicted to have an overall annual economic impact of between $89 and $769 million, depending on whether you're very conservative in your estimates or very optimistic. But even if you take kind of a mid-range estimate, $319 million of total economic benefit from the partnership in just 5 years.
Of course, that economic benefit is predicated on the state actually helping us out to achieve the maximum potential from bringing these two institutions together. And there is a lot of competition around the country and around the world in this area. And every place you see a orange dot on this slide is a place that's a major biotechnology center that is trying to achieve some of the similar goals that we are. And some of the highlights from the last couple of years are $500 million for an effort to move a version of the Scripps Clinic to Florida. A recent announcement of $750 million from the state of Wisconsin in support of their bioscience initiatives, and the recent approval by California voters of $3 billion over 10 years for stem cell research.
So our ability to maintain our competitive starting position on this project really depends on some help from the state to help us really reach our maximum potential. But we are very confident that this partnership has significant potential to build on our previous investments, and with some additional support from the state, we will be able to compete as leaders in this area. So the summary is that we want to build on the existing expertise and previous investments and really move this science forward for the benefit of the people of Minnesota. There is a limited window of opportunity because the competition is significant. Mayo and the University of Minnesota have provided significant resources and will continue to do so. We have already seen the benefit of working together closely in this area, and we're excited about being able to move forward. And we hope to have Minnesotans benefit first from the activities of the Minnesota Partnership. And if anybody wants further information about the partnership or about the economic impact statement, all of that information is available online at this somewhat long and complex URL of mayouminnesotapartnership.org. And with that, Dr. Power and I would be pleased to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Bradley.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate, I think, and we should remind ourselves, I know in terms of, this gets a little bit tricky in terms of focusing on a bonding request because some of them are new and some of them we've sort of had universal endorsement. I think this has been one of those projects we've had really great bipartisan universal endorsement. But I question that you sort of hinted at, and maybe if our presenters could just bridge for us sort of the difference and what those are, because actually I think I just learned this morning that the steel and the concrete are one part of it, but actually there's another part of it, which I believe is part of sort of the complexities of sharing facilities.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, sure, I'd be happy to elaborate a bit more on the construction costs. Of course, I'm not the construction person, so I don't have the great details. But the essence of the increased cost from last session has to do with the progress from the pre-design phase to the design phase, plus increases in the cost of steel and concrete, due largely, I'm told, to the magnitude of construction projects in China. So about $2 million of that increased cost is due to the increased cost of steel, and as you noted, the need to more formally and completely separate the mechanical systems for the two condominiums that would be present in this building. And this is something that is necessary to comply with state law and was not built into that original estimate. The additional $1 million plus of that is due to the increases in the cost of concrete, and to the fact that as this moved into the design phase, there was a great deal of concern about reusing some of the concrete panels that cover the outside of this building now, and the thought that it was going to be necessary to replace those from front for the top floors where the construction is going to be going on. So that's what I have in terms of the background for why the cost has gone up significantly.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to lead you into a trap, so to speak, here. And in reference to yesterday's nanotechnology comments, would the Minnesota partnership, medical partnership, ever consider buying used equipment for your endeavor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we consider everything. So in the direct answer to your question, sure, we consider it. Is that likely for a lot of the equipment we need? I'll let Dr. Power answer for his impression of this based on his experience, but my answer to that would be that's not terribly useful in the context of the fast-moving scientific environment that we're competing in here. The reality is that the high-throughput instruments that are necessary for making the measurements that we need to do to correlate molecular changes with the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of disease, that instrumentation goes out of date within about 2 years. So anything that's older than about a year and a half is out of date and not terribly useful. And our problem that we have in a practical sense is keeping up with the fast-moving technology so that we can get the latest instrumentation and remain our in our competitive position as the science moves forward. So practically, it's not a very useful alternative for most of our needs.
So I will just...
You win.
Okay. You don't really have to go down that road. He answered the question very well for Representative David's. And I want everyone to remind Representative David that I can still open them.
Any other questions? Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we're making a statement against recycling when it's appropriate, however, though, right? Because we do understand that the environment has limitations, and especially, you know, as every one of the capital requests in the previous...
That's completely recycling, isn't it?
Well, I mean, everybody's being asked to cut costs, and so I don't think we'd be against any sort of recycling. I just want to balance a little bit of my colleagues' enthusiasm here to ensure that we figure out ways to also, if possible, reuse and, you know, figure out ways to make these. In fact, maybe the nanotechnology, I don't know, I thought you were going somewhere else with your comment. Maybe there's some nanotechnology applications available to you right now, I don't know, and that might be, as we were hearing yesterday, the costs would be half, and the, I don't know, is that something you're looking at all, nanotechnology?
Representative Clark, yeah, we're working hard to identify any new avenues that do reduce the cost of staying competitive. In response to your concern about do we get the maximum use of the equipment we have, at Mayo, we do have a program where laboratory equipment that is no longer state-of-the-art enough for our cutting-edge research is donated to either other local area universities or for some of the less high-tech equipment back to the area high schools. So we do make an effort to make sure that this equipment gets a maximum useful shelf life and can be used to train the next generation of scientists.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, if I may, we're actually, in a way, recycling this building by adding to the top of it. We are not abandoning an old building. We're not digging any more holes in the ground. So we're using the same parking facilities and ventilation facilities and whatnot, and we're just building up. So that was our attempt to try to be conservative.
Very well. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for your presentation. By the way, members, I think I'll get that bill today. Is that right? Yes or no, Frank?
Very soon.
Very soon. Anybody interested in co-authoring it, please let me know. With that, thank you very much, doctors. And now we're going to talk to another part of this whole picture. We're going to talk with the Deed folks about the bioscience infrastructure zones. So we won't probably get all of the things that Deed has for their bonding presentation, but we'll certainly take them one at a time, and I thought this one was very appropriate. Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Paul Moe, Director of Business and Community Finance for Department of Employment and Economic Development. We have three components of the governor's capital bonding request. The first one we're going to cover is bioscience, and I'm going to have Gene Guider, who's been primarily responsible for activity as it relates to bioscience, and give a brief overview of the activity to date in those zones and then how this money would be used in this capacity. So, Gene, if you want to...
Mr. Goddard, give your name for the record.
Yep.
Hold on a second. Here it comes. All right.
My name is Gene Goddard, Mr. Chair and Committee. I am the Bioscience Industry Specialist for the Department. I'll go over the Bioscience Zone summary quick of the Bioscience Zone and then the Governor's recommendations for the bonding this year. The Bioscience Zones were created in the 2003 legislative session to help facilitate technology transfer, business development, and business collaboration with the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. The zones are located in the three cities of Minneapolis, Rochester, and St. Paul, approximately 500 acres per community. zone properties are located near the U of M, both the Minneapolis and St. Paul campuses, and the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and the facilities it has downtown and facilities it has on the western side of Rochester, where many of you were at the State of the State address yesterday for the Mayo Collaborative Services building. Many of the zone properties are deteriorated and underutilized, particularly in Minneapolis and St. Paul, in the old heavy industrial and railroad properties up near 280 and 94 and over towards the university's campus. Many of them would continue to be underperforming, and we included them in the zone to help facilitate business growth. The bonding recommendation for the Bioscience Zone under the governor's proposal is $15 million. The Bioscience Zones also provide businesses with opportunities to access some tax incentives. $1 million was approved during the 2003 session for fiscal year 2004-05 to provide the corporate franchise tax, sales tax, a property tax, which is optional, an employment tax credit for high-paying jobs, and research and development tax credit. You might note that the average biotechnology job or bioscience job in the nation right now pays about $64,000 compared to the average U.S. job in the economy is roughly $32,000. So these are significant high-paying jobs. The Minneapolis Bioscience Zone, some of the things that they'll be working on to help improve this property is stormwater management development, creation of new roads near the Greenway Parkway and Consota Parkway. You'll see the maps in the next slide. And there's quite a bit of site prep and development work that needs to take place. The Minneapolis zone is located in these green areas highlighted on your presentation. The Life Science Corridor, Minneapolis Life Science Corridor, runs from the HCMC facility and the Metrodome down Chicago Avenue towards the Sears Tower, including Abbott Northwestern Hospital and the facilities that are around that. And then the area called University Research Park is located near the Minneapolis East Bank campus and runs over towards the St. Paul City line. The development that they're looking for assistance for is located in what's called the University Research Park area. And you can see in your map the location of the different roads that need to be developed to access these sites to make them available for new growth and then the cleanup that needs to take place there. The Rochester Bioscience Zone is focusing on the development of a property near the Stabil building, which you just heard about, which would then be cleaned up for a new development, construction of parking facilities, and a 15,000 square foot bioscience incubator to help facilitate the new technology spin-offs from the University of Minnesota Mayo Partnership, as well as other business growth opportunities from new business startups coming out of the Mayo Clinic environment, as well as that partnership there. You see the Rochester zones are located throughout the community. Those are highlighted in yellow, all of downtown, properties near the east campus of the Rochester University Center, and then over on the west side of town near facilities of the Mayo Collaborative Services, the Support Center, IBM, and PEMSTAR, which are all involved in significant bioscience research and development. The St. Paul Bioscience Zone is focusing on the development of utility upgrades and site acquisition and site development near the University Enterprise Laboratory facility, improvements of roadways. There's some areas that are very hard to access in this area because of the railroads, so some bridges need to be developed and some roadways improved. The St. Paul Bioscience Zone is located in this area. You can see the yellow on your map. There's one property that's not located on this map is the old Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Facility on University Avenue, which has now been converted into a private sector-owned bioscience incubator, and that has seven companies in it right now. The University Enterprise Laboratories facility has six businesses and three organizations in it. So the zone is doing what it was intended to do, to help consolidate companies into a core area near the university and the Mayo Clinic. And then lastly, you just heard about the partnership, Minnesota partnership, and the bonding request that we have there. My presentation, any questions from the committee?
Any questions? Representative Clark.
One question. What was the total dollar amount
That's your request?
$3 million is the governor's request or recommendation for the bioscience zone. Okay. It's split between the three cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. Depending on each community's application to the department for funding and what their match would be towards those funds.
One other
question. Yes, one of several proposals I've heard that's going to be proposed, Representative Clark.
Pardon me?
Besides the governor's, I've heard of at least one other proposal.
For bioscience zone?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, on the high-paying jobs, employment tax credit for high-paying jobs, could you remind me what's considered a high-paying job in your...
Under the legislation, it is any job over $30,000 a year. This industry average is $64,000 per year, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. So and from the companies that we are in negotiation with right now, there isn't one job being created that's less than $30,000. All of them are over the $40,000 to $50,000 range. Most of them are scientists, bioscience sales staff, and executives to grow these companies. We have Minneapolis City Council has approved two companies so far, and we have four under negotiation with the City of St. Paul at this point.
Mr. Chair?
Good morning,
Clark. Interesting. I wonder if you could give us a breakdown on the executives versus the other, such as maybe all of the different divisions, because I know we have, at least in the bioscience zone in Minneapolis, I think we have one extremely high-paid executive, and I'm wondering if that's swaying any of this. So I'm just, you don't have to tell me the breakdown now, but I would be interested to know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, for the companies that we've talked with, they're mostly startup companies, so they have two executives, typically a CEO and a senior vice president, and then the rest of the staff are researchers and technician staff. Two companies that are located in Minneapolis, I'm not familiar with what that executive is being paid.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I wasn't talking about new companies.
Okay. Most of these firms are startup firms. Most of them are from the state, and we have one moving into the zone right now that's just moved in from Texas. So it's pulling in companies from around the country.
It's very positive. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I want to point out to everybody that Mr. Goddard's from Martin County, and that's why we got it done so quickly. With that, Ron would like to make a statement.
Mr. Chairman and members, I just want to clarify for everyone that we're getting a lot of numbers being thrown out here. For example, just recently we had a number of 24-3, and now I understand there will be a bill that will reflect that number. But you have to remember that everything from last year's bonding bill no longer exists. If you want a project that you thought was in last year's bill, or is in House File 3, which is Representative Dorman's bill, or the governor's recommendations, those exist. But anything else does not exist. And so don't assume that just because you had a bill last year that you have a bill this year, because everything is dead from last legislative session. And I want people to understand that. The other thing is that I'm just looking for some clarification how you want to handle some other items. As I'm tracking the sheet, I'm putting down each of the numbers of the different bills, whether it be the governor's recommendation, it be House File 3, which was the Representative Dorman's bill that he put in as kind of a starting board for discussions, as well as bills introduced by individual members. And so when you see the sheet, you're going to see possibly 3, 4, 5 numbers, all reflecting different dollar amounts. And I'm just looking for people, not today, but to think about how you want to handle that when we get to the ranking, or you're just going to send the idea that you think the project is sufficiently important that you would recommend it and just show the different amounts requested. So I just want you to think about that, everyone. And also the audience or members of the public, if you have a concept, we have to work off of legislation.
There you go.
Thank you.
Very well put. Any other messages from the members? Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.